Hack the Entrepreneur is part of Rainmaker FM, the digital business podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm. Let's take a moment to thank today's sponsor, designcrowd.com. Have you ever considered starting your own business or launching a startup? If the answer is yes, then you're probably going to want a great logo design as well as a website made. This is where designcrowd.com can help. Here's how it works. Step one, simply visit designcrowd.com/hack. You will get your special offer for being a listener. Then you just post a brief description describing the design that you need. For example, a brand new logo. Step two, DesignCrowd will then open your project to their 500,000 designers to respond to your offer. Step three, within hours, you will receive your first design, and over the course of the next 3 to 10 days, a typical project will receive 60 to 100 different designs from designers around the world. Step four, you then simply pick the best design that you like and the designers will get paid. As a special bonus, if you do not find a design you want, absolutely no problem. The risk is not on you. DesignCrowd has a money-back guarantee. Crowdsourcing design on DesignCrowd helps you access the collective creativity of hundreds of thousands of designers that will save you money, time, and resources and help you find the best designs possible. Check out designcrowd.com/hack. That's designcrowd.com/hack. And you'll get up to $100 off your very next project.
Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today has transitioned from wanting to become a cartoonist to being a founding partner and COO of an 8-figure media and software company. He's founded numerous companies over the past 20 years, including freelance designer, blogger, and educator. He has spent the past 6 years as partner and COO of Rainmaker Digital. Now, let's hack Tony Clark. I want to take a moment to thank today's sponsor, Square. It's hard getting paid for your work. Tracking people down and waiting for their checks is a time-consuming pain. Square lets you send an invoice just like you're sending an email. Send invoices from your office or right from the job site with your smartphone or tablet. Just send an invoice like you're sending an email. Your customers click and go to a secure payment link and enter their credit card or debit card. You see deposits in your bank account in 1 to 2 business days. Send invoices free and only pay for the processing. It's just 2.9% plus 30 cents for each invoice that gets paid online. There are no subscription fees. No fees to your customers, nothing. Square keeps track of all your invoices so you can see what's been paid and what's outstanding, and you can send a reminder invoice when you have to. You can also schedule recurring invoices for customers who do a lot of business with you, and for a little bit more, you can even keep customers' cards on file so you can charge them automatically. Go to square.com/hack to start sending invoices for free and get free processing on up to $500 in sales. That's square.com/hack. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very special guest, Tony. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's absolutely my pleasure. I know this is going to be a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
So what do you say we jump into it?
Cool.
All right, Tony, you are a man that wears and has worn many hats. But today we're talking to Tony, the entrepreneur. So Tony, could you tell me, as an entrepreneur, what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
The one thing I do or try to do consistently is get out of my own way. And what I mean by that is a lot of times as entrepreneurs and as business people and in life, whether we're parenting, whether we're, you know, in a relationship, we tend to let our thinking kind of get in the way, and we stumble over our thinking. We overanalyze, we overthink, and we take those thoughts to be kind of gospel. So we think, and then we take those thoughts and say, hey, this is the way it is, when the reality is it's a perception. So what I try to do, and what I've consistently tried to do, and it's a practice, it's something I'm always trying to do, is recognize that thoughts and thinking are good, but the real creative and innovative thinking happens in the form of insights when we kind of get out of our own way, get out of our thinking, and kind of trust that instinct or sort of that inner wisdom to kind of guide us along, rather than everything being overanalyzed and kind of getting us in that paralyzed state.
Ah, I like this. So is it that sort of like analysis through paralysis through analysis? Like, so do you sort of mean like think about it, but then stop and take action and then kind of see where it leads? Or
yeah, you know, depending on what it is. I mean, I'm also a data guy, so I trust data. So it's kind of like this intersection of instinct and intuition, or sort of that inner wisdom and data, real facts, reality that you can measure. And that intersection is where I find that I'm most successful, and the projects and the things we do are most successful. So it's more of a getting the facts together and doing initial research, getting it to a point where I'm comfortable with the reality of it. I'm comfortable with the data. I'm comfortable with, and it doesn't have to be 100, for me anyway, it doesn't have to be 100% definitive. It's got to be enough that, okay, this looks like a logical way to go. And then I try to get out of my way and let sort of this instinctual thing take over. Because you notice a lot of time, I mean, there's the Archimedes, the eureka moment in the bathtub when he relaxed. And you hear those stories all the time of people that when they get to a point where they stop thinking, or they stop worrying about the solution, or trying to come up with the answer, or try and figure out the problem, it's in that quiet time that the answer comes to them. And it's always almost like it comes from a place that you never would have expected. So it's almost like an even better answer than if you would have tried to do it. And then I use data to kind of confirm that and the reality of research. And it's that intersection. So yes, do the research, get a pretty good understanding of what it is I'm trying to accomplish, kind of get out of my way, let things marinate. And all of a sudden, there's this insight, and at that insight, then you compare it to the data and make sure that the choice that you've made is a sound one. And 9 times out of 10, if I did get out of my way, or actually I would say 99.999%, if I get out of my own way, it's actually the right answer and the data just confirms it.
Yeah, there we go. So the famous like entrepreneur in the shower, and the bright idea finally comes because they finally get screens, phones, everything out of their face, and they stop thinking for like 2 seconds, and then it's like, there it is. There's the answer.
Exactly. Yeah. And what's great is science backs this up. I mean, the shower thing is actually, I wish I could remember the study, but they actually did a study and they found that the relaxation of the warm shower, the fact that you're doing something that requires a bit of attention, but not a lot of attention, because when you wash yourself and wash your hair and you have a routine, so you go through the routine, and then the relaxation of the sound and everything kind of naturally puts you in this almost meditative state, which is why people love to take showers. And that's why a lot of times ideas come in the showers, because you've that sort of process thinking has gotten out of the way. So your kind of intuitive thinking can kind of jump in there and, kind of give you that insight thinking. Yeah.
Shower studies. I could get into science.
Yeah.
If that's what we're doing.
Exactly. Yeah. That's my kind of science.
I didn't think I liked science.
Exactly.
Nice. All right. So Tony, we need to go back if we can, because you've been with Rainmaker Digital and Copyblogger Media before that for quite some time, but I know that's not like your first sort of kick at the entrepreneurial can. So if we can go back, or you can take us back, please. There seems to be this time, not always going through it, but oftentimes when you look back, where there's this sort of defining moment in your life where you either decided you had to create something bigger than yourself and make this huge difference in the world, or as mostly seems to be the case, you just found that you simply couldn't work for somebody else anymore. So could you take us back to that moment in your life and then also tell us which side of the fence you see yourself on?
Yeah. Well, I always, growing up, I always wanted to be a cartoonist, and I drew a lot. And I did, my own kind of underground comics in high school and, printed them in the library or the dean's office. I would actually get sent to the dean's office on purpose, knowing that the dean left and did stuff, and I would use the copy machine to make comics, and then I would stuff them in my folder and then sell them, around the school. Charles Schulz was a huge, from Peanuts, was a huge influence on my life, his story and the way he, you know, did his art and everything, but really as a way of when I read so many biographies about him and about his story, it was more the freedom. And so I had this understanding in my belief, it was that I had to be an artist or cartoonist. That would get me what I was after. That's what I really wanted. And it wasn't until later on I realized that it wasn't necessarily the drawing of the cartoons or the art that I wanted to do. It was using my creative thinking to get me the freedom to not have to work for somebody else. Because, you know, I was a hoodlum in high school. I was always, you know, kind of, I was the prankster, the jokester. I was always, you know, I would sell hall passes that were forged. I mean, I was the quintessential cut up and rebel in high school. I was in a metal band. I skated, I surfed. And, you know, I just knew that a life of a 9-to-5 job just was never going to work for me. So I just always assumed I was going to be a cartoonist and an artist. And I tried that for a long time. And then when my wife got pregnant with my first child, I realized that the starving artist thing was great, but that's not going to pay for, you know, having a family, and that it was time to kind of grow up and, you know, got a real job. So I started looking around and seeing where I could take some of that creativity and turn it into a job. So, you know, I looked at the typical places, you know, design and that kind of stuff. And a friend of mine, this was 95. So a friend of mine was doing HTML and web design. And they're like, you know, there are so many companies that need this and nobody knows about it. You can basically, you know, with your kind of, you know, sweet talking skills and, you know, your, I don't want to say shyster kind of way, but, you know, the way I could sell myself as a web designer. And I had no idea what I was doing. So I went to the store and I got a dummy's book on how to do HTML and also an advanced, a real advanced, like, you know, somebody really knows what they're doing book. And I basically put together a portfolio on a floppy disk and basically started interviewing and selling myself as a web designer. And this was 95, so there wasn't a lot of, at least in the Charlotte area where we were, there wasn't a lot of, you know, people doing this. So I got my first gig as a contractor, and it all kind of took off from there that I started doing web design. And I kind of built a web design company that eventually became a software company that eventually became a consulting company. And, wow. You know, and then eventually I sold that to my partner and moved on to Copyblogger. So,
wow, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So you found an opportunity basically with web design, and you knew that you had the ability to sell. Mm-hmm. And so you just had to learn the skill that you were going to sell.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, I had a design. I mean, being an artist, I had a design eye. So I was actually able to put together some really, you know, for the 90s, you know, this is the mid 90s. I put together some really nice designs compared to what other people were doing. At least in the space I was working in, the corporate space. And so I can kind of combine the two, and I realized I really liked it. I enjoyed the problem solving of people had a need to put stuff on the web, and it had to, you know, meet certain guidelines, but there was constraint. I always liked dealing with constraints. So there's not a, you know, there were at that time, you know, there was a lot of, it was all dial up, and, you know, web pages had to load quickly and be small, but you wanted them to look nice. So I had to learn all these tricks on how to do compression and all this stuff. And I realized at that point that this kind of combination of more of a technical kind of data or factual, like reality, what's the reality of what you have to deliver and the constraints around it and the creativity of being an artist and design really kind of fed what I was looking for. And it wasn't a real job to me. I loved getting up every day. I mean, I always joke that I could never have a boss that I would, you know, I have a problem with authority. I always have. So I couldn't have a boss. However, with clients, I would bend over backwards to make them happy, because not only were they paying me, but it was this, you know, when you have a client that you're doing work for, when they realize, wow, you've given me what I've asked for, and this is a huge deal. And there was a completely different context. So I found that I have discovered that freedom along with, you know, being able to work within that world that I wanted to. And that I remember having this aha moment that it wasn't being a cartoonist that really drew me to the story of Charles Schulz and what he did. It was the freedom that he was doing creative things on his own terms and living his life on his own terms. And that's really what I wanted out of life.
There we go. That's awesome. And really it seems like the whole, if there's an underlying sort of thing tying most of the people I talk to on this show, it's really that problem with authority, finding out that you're kind of unemployable and really just wanting to create stuff.
Right.
And get paid to create stuff and live the life that you want.
Exactly.
I love it. And just basically finding ways to do that. But we do have to, you brushed over something really quickly there that I didn't know. You were in a metal band?
Yeah, I was.
What did you play?
I sang. I actually went through, at a voice coach in training, and I actually trained in vocal tech to learn to do, you know, sing metal, screaming, falsetto. And I sang in a couple of different bands. And
can we find these bands anywhere?
I really enjoy that. No, they were, you know, it's one of those, is I think I might have a cassette tape somewhere, but they were extremely obscure, and they were very much not the, it was sort of, it was in the metal age that it was the more Guns N' Roses type stuff, but before Guns N' Roses became popular. So you had the Winger and the, you know, that kind of Poison soft hair metal band. And I was doing the more hard kind of, you know, punk influenced kind of stuff. And it hadn't reached its popularity yet. So really it was more just local stuff in Florida and just singing in different places. But, you know, I'll still do karaoke every now and then, because it was, it's like, you know, once you learn how to do it, you keep doing it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's awesome. And whether it's a good thing or not, I'm not sure yet, Tony, but the idea that you and I both like played in bands a lot during, like, before the time of like cell phones and YouTube, because obviously people doing it now, they're going to, in 10 years or 20 years from now, it's going to be like, it's all going to be there.
Yeah.
We don't have that issue.
No, I know. It's funny. My kids will find old, you know, photo albums of pictures of practice. And, you know, some of them I keep hidden because of, you know, the metal lifestyle. I was a surfer and punk too, that it was a very different lifestyle. And we photographed it, which, you know, probably should have burned those photos a long time ago, because it's evidence.
Incriminating,
you
know? Photos.
Exactly. But I kept them in there. They stay hidden, you know. But it's funny, my brother was in a band too. And this was in the scene in Florida, where we all played at the same clubs at places like that Marilyn Manson played, you know. And he, Brian Warner, the guy that is Marilyn Manson now, actually worked at the record store with a friend of mine, a former roommate of mine. And, you know, it's funny, it was like sort of the small, close-knit, not really close-knit, it was almost a competitive nature, but there were all these bands that kind of came out of that South Florida scene that were actually much better than the bands I was with. So it's, you know, they found the right
Warner,
knit.
I had no idea that was his name.
Yeah. Pretty sure that's the full name.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy. But he was interesting back then too. So
yeah, that's cool.
But he's it's funny, people give him a hard time and everything, but I mean, he's an example of an entrepreneur that kind of took a gimmick, mm-hmm. and kind of turned it into something that, you know, obviously worked. You know,
in a lot of ways, he took Alice Cooper and just modernized him.
Exactly, that's exactly what he did. And even back then, I mean, people at some of the clubs would give him a hard time because it was very different than what was there. But you could tell that they had a sort of a marketing mindset almost, or a kind of tapping into that, what people were looking for kind of thing. So
exactly. And you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Just
exactly.
Bring something that exists and has done well and bring it to a new market. You're typically golden. So, Tony, at the beginning, you said your one thing is the ability to get out of your own way. Now, every business expert talks about the 80-20 rule. You're supposed to do what you're good at, delegate the rest. Can you tell me something, Tony, in your business that you are absolutely not good at?
There's a lot of them. It's funny. One of the things I found is I've kind of grown my former business, my former company, and then sold to my partner, and then this business is... There are a lot of things that there are people better suited for. So coding, for example, I can code. I can write HTML. I can do design. I can write PHP. I know .NET. You know, I wrote all that code. However, it wasn't that great. It did what it was supposed to do. But there are people, I always like finding people that are better than me, that have a passion for that piece of it, and letting them kind of take it and run the ball. Sometimes that's hard to be hands off, but I tend to be more of a hands off type of man, not hands off, not a micromanager, but also not more of letting people kind of do what they do well. But, you know, when it comes to, I prefer to do things at the strategy level, and that's what excites me. So implementation, you know, I like to have maybe a manager or a person that can kind of take the plan and do all the fine details and that sort of thing. I don't like having to deal with the detail work. I can, and I have, but I found that the things that you don't necessarily like to do are the things you're not really that good at anyway, so it's better to have somebody else do it anyway.
Yeah, there we go. So that must have been hard, though. I mean, when you, as Copyblogger was sort of being built, you were the first partner, right? with Brian. And then, I mean, having coding and design skills and stuff, and then obviously partnering with Brian Gardner, who is really brilliant at design. And so it must have been sort of a hard thing, I guess, for you. You probably didn't, that was probably when you had to pull out of it, I'm assuming?
Yeah, and I was happy to do it.
Oh, okay, nice. Yeah, so most people, it's like, no, I want to do it. I've always done it.
No, I don't have a problem giving up on those types of things. I mean, so when we were building Teaching Cells, our sort of first product, I wrote all that by hand and cobbled together a bunch of stuff to build the membership site. I mean, it wasn't pretty behind the scenes. It was pretty in the front, and it worked good, but it was kind of a mess behind the scenes. And then sort of our last version of that, we really needed to look at, you know, something more stable. So we turned, you know, we had a lot of WordPress stuff going on, but I wanted to kind of build a WordPress, everything on one WordPress platform. And so we began looking at frameworks to use. And Genesis, obviously, to me, and it's funny because I didn't even really know Brian Gardner that well at the time. I knew who he was. I knew about StudioPress, but only kind of, you know, just as another brand out there, not really a lot about it. So I did a ton of research on the different frameworks and what was out there. And Genesis was by far the best one. It was coded well. It was clean. So I was actually a customer before. So I bought a license and I built a custom child theme on top of it for Teaching Cells. And I was like, man, this is great. I don't have to deal with all this underlying stuff. I can just focus on the design. And we built off of that. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and eventually Brian started talking. And, you know, when he said, let's bring StudioPress, I was like, yes, definitely, because this is, you know, unless we're going to build our own framework, this is the one I would want to use. And that sort of, so when Brian Gardner came on, and Nathan, who actually built the framework with Brian, I gladly turned it over to them, because, you know, looking at their code and using their code on my own stuff and the stuff we were doing with Teaching Cells, that I realized they were way better than I could have been. So it was much better for everybody if I just turned it over to them and let them do it.
So again, even in a different way, that is you getting out of your own way.
Exactly.
Where most people would want to just hold on to that, because that's kind of like what got you to where you are. So you would think that that's going to get you to where you want to be. And then how did you become sort of like operations officer? So COO, like, was that just something you were really good at? Or was it?
Yeah, it was sort of
something you had to develop.
Well, it was funny because that was sort of my role with Copyblogger. Well, Unglued Media was our company that Copyblogger was kind of part of. So that was sort of my role. I was on the blog when I came on to kind of handle a lot of the contract stuff we had to do with, you know, website stuff and that kind of thing. So that role just kind of expanded as we, you know, when we brought all the partners together and kind of formed this larger company that became Copyblogger Media and now Rainmaker Digital. It was like there were some obvious roles that people, you know, kind of fit into. And from an operations side, I'm good at wearing a lot of hats and doing a lot of things and kind of jumping into where I need to be. I think I have a strength at helping people, managing in a way that kind of helps people kind of bring out what's good in them, you know, to kind of, you know, do the job. And a lot of what I do is that kind of really, you know, it's funny, I joke that really my job is more like a plumber. I get the, you know, what flowing. And when things get clogged up, I get it flowing again. And we won't use the word because we'll keep this at a PG rating.
I was lost slightly, but I'm like, oh, I get it.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say the word and I was like, wait, does that suddenly make this an R rating? So I need to not say it.
I appreciate that. All right, Tony. So let's move, if we can, to projects. And projects is a loose term, so whether it's a big project or a little project, whether it was the podcast you started or whether it was one of the new businesses you started along the way, we heard how you started your first one, or whether it's a project now within Rainmaker Digital that you want to run after. But I would love to know sort of what your process is as an entrepreneur, and whether it's like an internal gut process or whether you have a written process as an operations officer. But what is it that you go through when an idea comes through your head in the shower, as you said, or on a walk, or through your inbox from somebody else? What is the process you go through to decide that a project is worth yours and possibly your team's time, energy, and resources?
You know, that's a really interesting question because that has changed so many different times over the course of my career, because when it's a one or two person company, your process is very different than as you grow. And one of the things that I've encountered personally is some growing pains growing to a company this size, trying to maintain those smaller kind of lightweight processes to get stuff done or get ideas kind of prototyped or whatever. In a larger organization, it becomes a lot more complicated. And I've had some stumbles that, you know, where managers have not kind of really had all the information they need to accomplish what they accomplished because I was still kind of doing it in that smaller route. So what I've found is that, and this is something I've learned within the past couple of years, is that the project process or the methods I go through whenever I have an idea for a project or Brian or we talk about stuff has to fit the context of your organization at that time in history. So if it's just one or two person, it's easier to do. But trying to do that same type of thing with a larger team when there's a lot of things going on changes everything. And that I think that's an important thing because a lot of people that kind of start out as an independent entrepreneur working for themselves and then kind of grow into this larger organization, a lot of sort of the downfalls of some of those startup entrepreneurs or founders is they continue to try and maintain those small, the way of doing things, the smaller team, and it doesn't work. So that's to say that I think that the process needs to fit the context, and I think that's very key. Now, within our organization, we have a lot of different projects going on. And one of the things I'm working on now is a kind of a, we'll call it a skunkworks project. You know, it's like the days of the skunkworks that, you know, built the plane in Germany. It's that same concept of it's a small team with an idea, few key people, not a big budget, not taking away from other things going on, going off and trying to put something together that's a really cool product as a, you know, a low impact right now on the organization. But the product, if it comes out right, could be a huge impact on the organization. And I'm finding that that's the kind of stuff I like to do most. So you take a small team of key people you need, you know, a designer, a developer, you need somebody, you know, if it's, you know, you might need somebody from your infrastructure side or your network side or whatever, you're going to need a copywriter or somebody to do some copy, you know, small team, you go, you plan out the stories of what this product's going to be from the customer perspective. So you write out these stories, you know, you write out your concept story and you write out use stories and use scenarios of what it's going to be. You map it all out. And then you have your team start to build key pieces from that. And then you release it and then you iterate and you try and keep the small team. And then if it takes off and it's a success, then you kind of bring it into the larger organization, kind of implement it with your larger support team and all that kind of stuff. So that's sort of kind of where I'm at now working on, you know, a kind of an internal project. But I think the key thing I've learned is those processes and the way you do things when you're small in a smaller organization doesn't necessarily work when you're bigger. And you think that would be common sense, but a lot of people get caught in that trap, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I had said it as a statement like 10 minutes ago or so, but that whole what got you to here won't get you to there.
Yes.
It's a brilliant book I just like read actually, which was this analysis of like executives within companies. And it's always what we think got us to here. It's like, well, if I just do that, like 10x that.
Right.
And it's like, actually, no, that got you to here. And that's the peak. Now you have to completely like paradigm shift what you were doing.
Absolutely.
To get to the next places. But so I love this. This is the process needs to fit the context. I've never heard of this idea of skunk works, but I'm definitely going to look into it. So this new idea. So it's interesting, like the idea of what got you here, Tony, won't get you to there. And you saw like the context within a larger company, but now you've broken off a smaller one. And so what's the idea? Is that because you're going to try and treat this like a smaller thing to get it done quicker or more? Do you know what I mean? Like what brought you through that realization of realizing context in the process? What brought you to now want to go skunkworks and like knock this one out separately?
It was one of those things where I saw, talking to a lot of people within the organization. It's an idea we've wanted to do for a while. It keeps coming up. It's one of those things it's something that keeps bubbling up to the top. Eventually you're like, okay, we need to do this. And it kept bubbling up. And we have a lot going on in the company. And, you know, we have a lot of, you know, people that are really busy. So when this came up again, it was one of those like, okay, how can we accomplish this? Because we know we need to do it. I want to do it. I'm personally excited about it. How can we do this in a way that won't negatively impact the company, but will give us, you know, some resources to at least get a version out to, you know, kind of make sure that it's, you know, something that's worth pursuing. Not really almost like an MVP type of thing, a minimum viable product, but
almost
it is. But I think with this particular thing, and a lot of times with a larger company, you have to or a company that's known, a very minimal MVP, I think a lot of times will disappoint. It's got to have right. At least enough usefulness that I think that people focus too much on the minimal part of the MVP and not enough on the value part of the VMP. So the MVP, you need to focus on the value. So can we give the value that will allow us to kind of get feedback that, yes, this is the right way to do this with a small team? And it was, you know, again, I talked about constraints earlier, and that's what I love. I love working within constraints. I think there's a there's something to be said when you take the intersection of two different ideas and you work within the constraints of not having unlimited time, resources, and budget. And what can you put together within those constraints? Because a lot of times you end up with a better product because constraints breed creativity. That's just something I've always believed. And it's, I mean, you hear that a lot. 37 Signals, that's now Basecamp, they talk about that a lot, that constraints breeds creativity because you have to find a solution that works. You know, that's why, you know, we love people like MacGyver because they're able to come up with a solution with these minimal constraints. And it's very interesting when you can do that in a way that could have a larger impact on your company. And that's the whole idea of the Skunkworks. That's the whole idea of, you know, Steve Jobs kind of taking a group of people to go to build, you know, a separate Mac in a separate building. I mean, that whole concept of can we accomplish something big with a small team that doesn't impact the rest of the organization? And can we do it in a way that delivers something of real value? And then once you have that and you have that value, you can expand on it. And then it becomes part of the larger, you know, product set.
I love it. I love it. And your partner, Brian Clark, when he was on the show, it ended up being called, I believe, the creativity of constraint, because he talked about that. So it is a big part of the organization. So, but constraints and context, those are two things that are obviously very important to you as projects. But now this something else when you started this last part, which really caught me, was you're personally excited about this.
Yes.
Do you think, like, from the outside, it seems like that's almost what would drive something like this. If you didn't have that excitement, you probably, do you think you would still be able to drive this project in a Skunkworks kind of way and do it as effectively?
I don't think so. I think that's part of, that comes with, because it's infectious, right? So if you believe you can do something, then your team can believe you, they can do it. It's kind of like the, you know, the whole concept of, you know, survivors on an island and, you know, the leader having the mentality to kind of keep everybody focused on, you know, we can do this. And it's more than just cheerleading, because it's got to be, you know, this is one of those that the insight came to me that this is doable within the constraints we have. And I had done some research, so I knew it was. And if it was totally not doable, I mean, if it was really more of a pie in the sky type of thing, even if you're excited about it, but after a while you start continuing to see that it's not going to work, it's hard to maintain that excitement. So the excitement will get things started, but action and implementation and seeing progress is what keeps that momentum going. Excitement will only go so far, but you continue to recharge that excitement every time you've accomplished something along the path of the process. Because, you know, excitement, hey, this is great, but a lot of times people don't abandon bad ideas because they're excited about it, or they think the world needs this, even though maybe they didn't do the research, or, you know, they think it's a great idea, but it's not a great idea, or they're not willing to take input from other people and feedback when they're saying, hey, you know, what if you approach it this way? Oh, no, this is my idea. I think it's great. Let's just keep going this way. You can maintain that excitement. Eventually, you're going to burn out, and everybody's going to burn out because you're not accomplishing anything. So excitement will get you started. It's the motivation to continue comes from making progress and actually seeing results along the path.
Brilliant. I love it. I love it. All right, Tony, it's been a lot of fun. I want to wrap up on one final question for you.
Okay.
So from playing in a metal band, creating comics, through figuring stuff out in the 90s and starting in 95 with your first business, you have come a long ways to 2016. You've accomplished a lot of things. And so this idea I'm working with is called the entrepreneurial gap, which as entrepreneurs, as dreamers, as creators, we seem to sometimes live in this gap where we never see ourselves as successful. No matter what we accomplish, it's always at the horizon. So when you get this new project out, you'll see yourself as a success. Yet we both know, Tony, that right before you hit that, you're going to set 5 or 10 loftier goals into the future. When you hit that revenue target in 6 months, you're going to be, consider yourself successful, yet we both know that you'll just set bigger goals. It's how we do it. And like walking towards the horizon, the further you walk, the further away it always gets. From the outside, we look very successful, yet we live in this gap sometimes. So Tony, you've been at this game a long time. You've accomplished more than most people ever will at this point, but I'm sure there's been highs, lows, wins, and losses that we haven't got to talk about. Could you turn around right now and tell me how you feel about your entrepreneurial journey up until today?
I feel that it's been a journey. And when I say that, I realized probably about a decade ago that, you know, when they say that it's a journey, not a destination, there's a reality to that. And so what I've tried to do and continue to practice is to enjoy the process and the journey, because at some point we all end up at the same destination, and that's, you know, in a box or in an urn or something. So if you're always looking for the next thing, you're not enjoying the goal. It's better to have it's good to have a goal, but that goal is just another milestone on the journey, and you have to enjoy the process. So right now, I can look back on what I've done, and once I kind of really embodied that insight I had about, you know, focusing on the journey, I can see that I enjoyed everything. Even the lows I can look back on now and see that they got me to the next thing. So when I look back, it's all about the journey. And going forward, I'm going to hopefully be able to continue to practice that focusing on the journey, not just that end point.
Nice. And so by focusing on the journey, you're happy with it. It's fulfilling. Is it everything you thought creating comic books for a living would be when you were back in your 20s or teens?
The freedom I was looking for, I found. And I found it in a very different way than I expected to, but I have found it. And every day I try to maintain that kind of that focus on, this is what I wanted. I was after the freedom to live my life on my own terms. And the goal for me is to continue to remember that every single day.
I love it. I love it. All right, Tony, this has been a lot of fun. We need to, if we could, we've got to talk about your business, which is Rainmaker Digital, Copyblogger Media. And you had a great podcast up till a couple months ago that I would love with you to share with the listener, because I think it would help them a lot and they would really get a lot out of it and enjoy it. And also, if you could tell them where they could track you down online.
The podcast I did with Chris Garrett was The Mainframe, and it's on Rainmaker FM. You can find all the archived episodes there or on iTunes. And the best place to find me is on Twitter, and my handle is @NestGuy, NESTGUY.
How come? How come it's @NestGuy? I need to, that's totally irrelevant right now, but.
Yeah, my original concept for starting blogging when I started to get into more content-focused stuff in 2005, 2006 was building a empire from your nest. So Success from the Nest was my old blog. I think it's still around somewhere. But the idea of building an entrepreneur empire from the comfort of your own nest was something I always liked, because I like to kind of be home. So
I love it. I love it. So @NestGuy on Twitter. I'll link to that in the show notes for you. The Rainmaker podcast is on rainmaker.fm, the same as Hack the Entrepreneur. I'm going to track down a Charles Schulz biography to link to, also link to Rainmaker Platform, which is your flagship product at this point. And I'm going to see if I can find some Brian Warner, aka Marilyn Manson, for everyone to check out once you stop working out, walking, commuting to work, whatever it is you're doing right at this very moment. And then track down Tony, follow up with any questions, or just let him know you heard him on the show over at Twitter. Tony, once again, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. Thanks for sharing. Please keep doing what you're doing, man. It's awesome and inspiring to watch.
I will. Thanks, John. This has been a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Tony, thank you so much for joining me finally. I know I've said this already, but I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, and I'm glad we finally got to sit down and chat, and I learned some stuff about you that I didn't know. The whole singer in like a metal band in the 1980s. That's pretty awesome. So, Tony, as you probably noticed, is a really, really smart dude. And he's really smart in, I'm fascinated by what he does, because he's really, really smart in ways that I am really, really not smart. Operations. And so COO of a fairly sizable company and running operations of a software company is fascinating to me and really cool. And I dig it because of the fact that it's so different than the way my brain and sort of my strengths, where they lie. So I enjoyed the conversation immensely. I learned a lot from it, and I'm looking forward to going back through it. And because of that, I didn't just go back through it once. I didn't go back through it twice. I didn't go back three times, but I went back through the conversation four times, because there was so many things that Tony said that just sparked an idea in my head or sent my thoughts into a whole new direction. But that fourth time through, there was one thing that Tony said. There was one thing he said that was so very, very clear. Did you hear it? Did you get it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
When it's a one or two person company, your process is very different than as you grow. And one of the things that I've encountered personally is some growing pains growing to a company this size, trying to maintain those smaller kind of lightweight processes to get stuff done or get ideas kind of prototyped or whatever. In a larger organization, it becomes a lot more complicated. And I've had some stumbles that, you know, where managers have not kind of really had all the information they need to accomplish what they accomplished because I was still kind of doing it in that smaller route.
And that's the hack. Tony. I love this. This is crucial, right? So this is the whole context thing, and this is the changing. This is working in a startup style company where things aren't just hard and fast rules because things change so fast, right? And you as maybe you have a one person show, maybe that's what you are. Maybe you have 5 employees, maybe you have 10, but it's the goal is to be growing and expanding and changing quickly, right? As the market changes, as your product changes, as your service changes, as you build a team around you, these things change. The way I've heard this sort of discussed before, and I think fits really well, is that as a like the CEO, the person in charge, in Tony's case, it's the COO, but of a fast-growing startup-style company, meaning that it's ever-evolving and changing itself. The idea is that you typically have, in a role like this, like your role or like Tony's role, is you have 3 months to learn what you need to know. Then you have 3 months to do that stuff once you figured it out. And then you spend the next 3 months realizing that you no longer know what you need to know because your company has evolved past that point. And then you start over, spending 3 months figuring out what it is you need to know, then spend another 3 months doing that stuff. And then once again, takes you 3 months to realize that you no longer know what you need to know. This is constant growth, pushing yourself to learn, to build, and to do new things that take you out of your comfort zone. And as Tony says, it really makes you have to look at projects, makes you have to look at services, makes you have to look at products, makes you have to look at hiring, makes you have to look at marketing. Everything has to be done differently as you transition to these new phases of your business. But there are no defined points of them. So you just have to make sure that you're always looking for that context. Tony, thank you. So very, very well said. All right. That was an absolute blast, wasn't it? Hacktheentrepreneur.com. It's the website. Check it out. I know you'll dig it. Get on the email list. And yeah, I'll be sending you some emails, you know? All right. It's been fun. Take care. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.